Okay, we are on the air. Call the meeting, call the Finance Administration Operations Committee meeting, June 19th to order. Marlene, you please take the role.
Director Darcy.
Here.
Director Gonzalez.
Here.
Chair Peterson.
Here.
Chair, we have a forum.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm director, I'm Chair Wolf.
I know, I'm not on.
Is there any public comment? See anything? Okay. Item number four, approval of the minutes of the Finance Administration Operations Committee meeting held on May 15, 2013. Do we hear any comments about that? If not, motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed. Minutes are approved. Executive Director Mike Stone has some items today.
Just a couple of notes, Director. There were a couple of items on the procurement agenda and engineering agenda that weren't quite ready for this month's FAO committee. We hope to bring that to you in a future meeting. And then to introduce
our bonds to advance your fund all or portions of these two series. You can see that the 2005 series totals about $700 million. And the 2006 series totals just under $300 million. Some of the considerations that we discussed previously were the coupons, coupons on most of the 2005 and 2006 bonds were 5% coupons. That means under current yields, current market yields, there's an opportunity for us to issue new bonds and to call these bonds up on the earliest call date. In the case of the 2005 bonds, that call date is July 1 of this year. I'm sorry, July 1 of next year, 2015. I'm getting ahead of myself. July 1 of 2015 and July 1 of 2016 for the 2006 bonds. One of the issues, though, that we've been facing in recent years with respect to refunding is the fact that when we issue the new bonds and get the proceeds in an escrow to take out what you call the old bonds, that the escrow can't earn as much as what we're paying on the new bonds. So you have a loss in savings as a result of the fact that you're paying debt service on new bonds that is greater than the amount of investment return you can earn in your escrow, and that's what we refer to as negative arbitrage. That negative arbitrage reduces the potential savings you can get from a refunding. And you'll see as we go forward that it's pretty significant with respect to 2006 bonds, which have a longer call date, therefore a longer escrow, and therefore longer or more negative arbitrage. In the current market, we're now anticipating that we would refund approximately five of the eight Series 2005 maturities that are callable. That would total about $525 million in refunded bonds and would produce savings, present value, at about $35 million. So it's a little under 7% of the par value of the refunded bond, 6.7%. In the 2005 case, we also looked at it in terms of how much are you losing to negative arbitrage, and you are achieving, in this case, around 60 to 70% of the total savings that you could achieve if you had a perfect escrow. That's not a great percentage, but in this low interest rate environment, we think it's appropriate to move forward with those refunding candidates. The remainder of these bonds produce a lower level of present value savings and have a higher percentage of loss of the savings due to negative arbitrage. So those are, that's why these particular candidates, the total $468 million, are bonds that we would wait to refund, wait to get closer to the call date, and potentially achieve larger savings at that time.
What does that last clause mean? No individual maturity to produce time value savings above 4%?
What's reciting here is that the total of all of those would produce refunded a savings of 2.8% of our par value of bonds. And there's no single one of all of those different maturities. There's multiple maturities within that total mm-hmm. that would exceed 4%. Some of them are much lower, even near zero. So we try to give you a range of savings there. The savings on those candidates would be between 0 and 4%, depending upon which ones you chose. And the average is 2.8%.
I'm sorry, I'm just getting something. So the point of that is that you have to combine the different maturities in order to get the savings you want?
No, this was just a shorthand way of kind of presenting. We could show each individual candidate and show that one is 3.6% and one is 3.2% and others are close to zero. We just grouped them into the candidates we thought we should refund versus those that you would.
I think we're saying the same thing.
Okay.
Thank you.
But we could select, and it's possible for us, possible for us to select some out of this lower group and add them to the bonds that we want to take upon.
But we don't.
But we're recommending not doing that because of the level of savings. With respect to the timing and the group of firms that are assisting us with respect to this refunding, the senior managers, as approved by the board previously this year, are Goldman Sachs and Jefferies. Co-senior managers are Merrill Lynch and Seabird Grant Group Chain. And the co-managers are Duncan Williams, George K. Vaughan, Jan Montgomery, Robert Baird, and Williams Capital Group. There is one firm, Fidelity Investments, that was previously authorized by the board to be part of this group, but was never was able to complete all of the documentation necessary to work on the transaction, to be approved at the state level.
The disclosure forms. Okay. The disclosure forms, they never completed the disclosure forms.
Our anticipated schedule. We anticipate receiving ratings, bond ratings, on around June 25th. That's the time we would issue the preliminary official statement. Currently, what we would like to do is be prepared to price the bonds as early as Tuesday, the week of July 4th. The week of July 4th isn't typically the best week to price. It's a short week, people are gone. Those managing funds sometimes take days off like the rest of us. But the interest rate market has been trending up recently. So if you get a good day on Tuesday the 2nd, you have to prepare the price on that day. Otherwise, it could slide into the next week, the week after. And then we close sometime in the second half of July. In this particular case, we say July 16th or later. In this case, because we don't need the proceeds to spend on projects, we may actually want to extend the closing out longer, because the shorter the escrow is, the longer you wait to close, the shorter the escrow is, the less soon it's going to be of our very exciting stuff.
How long can you delay?
They think that when we spoke to the underwriter, they believe we could probably have a closing as long as about 4 weeks without incurring an interest rate penalty.
Okay.
Okay.
Any questions?
So you're saying before you don't think the market's strong enough to do the full transaction at this time right now, and that's why you want to postpone? Series.
We think that by waiting, two things are in our favor by waiting on some of these others that we're not refunding. One, as you wait, the bonds that you issue become shorter because you get closer to the maturity date. Therefore, you move down the yield curve. So shorter bonds are typically lower interest rates. The other advantage of waiting is the shorter the escrow is, you know, the closer you issue bonds, the time you call them out, the less you lose due to the fact that the investment return is less than what you're paying on bonds, so the less negative arbitrage. The factor working against us, or arguing to do them now, would be if the general trend of interest rates is up, that is going to offset some of the benefit of those two factors. So the three factors we're considering are the negative arbitrage of the escrow, the fact that you could move down the yield curve and potentially lower interest costs because you're issuing shorter bonds. But the negative factor is that the general level of interest rates, the whole yield curve, could be moving up.
And what are the financial advisors saying about
financial advisors are in agreement with the approach we're taking with respect to, the recommendation is based upon our discussions with them about the savings level for each of these individual maturities. The underwriters, of course, are more likely to say, let's do more of this, but the financial advisors, I think, are in agreement that there will be future opportunities to do these refundings, and it's likely to be an opportunity to achieve at least this level of savings, if not more, at some point in the future.
How do the activities of the Fed meeting, the current Fed meeting, feature into this? And if this goes a particular way, will you change? Do we have the capacity to change this decision?
Oh, yes. We can make the final decision on this really can occur as late as, a day or so before the transaction. I don't think there's an additional board action required because we've been authorized to fund up to this total amount. We need to know kind of the day before the transaction the candidates we expect to refund, so we know how large the size of the transaction. So, as we continue toward this pricing day, we can provide updates of what we think the market changes we have on this decision.
I think it would be helpful to send that to the members of this committee.
Sure.
Because particularly in this market, and I have a chart on my laptop that didn't come up on the screen, but looking at where the maturity yield is, I just wonder if this isn't going to be it. I think it went away. I don't know why it stayed on that. But, you see sort of what looks to be a very different trend in the last, a couple of months, as you mentioned, orally. I do think it would be good to get the advice of people on the committee about that last minute decision.
I would say within, since about the last month or so, that tax-exempt rates in the 10-year part of the yield curve, which is 5 to 10 is kind of where we're at, ended up about 40 basis points. And are about the levels they were a year ago, maybe a little bit higher than a year ago. We're still better off in funding now because we're closer to the call date than we would have been a year ago.
And obviously, it's hard to predict, but if you say about something that's going to affect this, then I think you might want to think
about it. Hopefully, as you comment today after the meeting, we'll shed a little more light on it.
Right, and then that happens immediately after that in the markets. I think, to the extent you can predict, will show us where the trends might be going. Thank you.
Okay. And one other item under finance renewal of the contract issued to the LA State Treasurer's Office.
Yes. Item one under finance is renewal of a contract through the Illinois State Treasurer's Office for a contract with Bank of America to provide banking services and armored car services, which Brinks provides through Bank of America. The renewal would be for a period of 1 year in an amount not to exceed $380,000. This is for our commercial banking activities that we conduct through the Treasurer's Office each year. The Treasurer does use the lead on this contract. They do the RFP along and have some of our staff on the evaluation committee. This was originally procured back in 2005 for a period, initial period of 4 years with 6 one-year renewals. I think this would be the 8th year. Treasurer's been very happy with the services provided by Bank of America, as have we. The estimated the fee schedule in the coming year, which would begin September 1, 2013, and go through August 31, 2014. Fee schedule would be unchanged. The treasurer has notified us, but we are reducing, or we are recommending a reduction in the upper limit for the coming year, because the fees have been less this year than what we anticipated a year ago. So we're going to reduce the upper limit from $400,000 for the last year, the year that's ending August 31st, to $380,000.
Is that the volume is decreasing for the armored cars? Is that continuing each year to go down in the need for the armored cars?
I don't think it's the armored car services. The prices aren't down, but the amount of activity we'll have, a number of different banking transactions, is less than we had anticipated, I think, last year. Plus, the fee schedule did change last year, so it wasn't totally known how that fee schedule change would impact our costs. So, it obviously impacted our process as we anticipated.
And this is a fourth of the 5-year renewal? Is that right?
No. There should be 6 renewals. There's an initial term of 4 years. Maybe we should have 6.
Should be 6. Okay. Any questions? Thank you. Thanks, Mike. There being no questions, then we need action on that. Go ahead, motion to approve item one in finance.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes for consent agenda. Thanks, Mike. Procurement had 5 items, now they have 3 items. Item one is being deferred to the future board meeting, a future board meeting, I believe, right? And item 3 is being also deferred to a future board meeting.
Hopefully to next week's full board meeting.
Next week's? Okay.
Yeah.
So both of these for this next coming week?
Item number 3, the plan is to take it to the full board.
Okay.
Item 1 will probably be in July.
Okay.
Okay.
So we have items 2, 4, and 5 to review.
That's correct. Okay. Well, good morning, everyone, once again. So, again, the first item was being deferred to a future board meeting, hopefully in July. The second item is a CMS contract for the TILA to purchase 11 medium and heavy-duty trucks. All of these trucks are replacement units and exceed our replacement criteria. This solicitation consisted of 5 line items, 4 of which were different trucks, and the other was a trade-in value for one of the 4. Vendors were not required to bid on all line items, and the low bidder for each line item was selected for award. Award is recommended to Prairie International Trucks Incorporated in a total amount not to exceed $1,184,169.
CMS didn't have a diversity or goal for this?
No, they didn't. And, you know, I did talk to CMS in regards to this, and there's a process that they utilize to set BEP goals on all procurements, and we utilize that same process. And the problem is there's not enough registered minority and women-owned businesses in the CMS, the small business, or DEP directory to even place a goal. The percentage would be so low, it'd be less than 1%. So therefore, that's why they don't place goals on these vehicle-related procurements. And that would be true if this was our procurement as well, based on the process.
Any other questions?
Okay. Again, we're skipping number three, as that's going to be deferred until the full board meeting. So the fourth item is a renewal of a tollway request for proposal to purchase or to continue services for our automated vehicle locating AVL system. This contract allows us to track vehicle location 24/7 and provides real-time reporting of vehicle activity, including idle time and speed reports. This system is used extensively during snowplow operations and allows the snow room to monitor plow truck location, salt application rates, and our ability to tell whether or not the plow blade is in the up or down position. And it can even provide road surface temperature on our system. This is the fourth of five possible renewal options, and award is recommended to Interfleet Incorporated in a total amount not to exceed $135,000.
Can it also tell us if beds on trucks are up?
Unfortunately, it's not that intelligent yet.
Would you work on that?
We could put that in our next RFP. Right, John?
Okay. Any questions about that?
None.
Okay.
All right, the fifth and final item is a renewal of a tollway request for proposal to continue our STAR 999 Motorist Assistance Program services. This service provides motorists with a STAR 999 cellular express line to report incidents on the tollway and other highways in northern northeastern Illinois. The vendor has approximately 38 agents on staff, which operate 24/7, 365 days a year. The vendor fields over 130,000 calls per year. IDOT utilizes this contract as well, and they reimburse the tollway for 50% of the cost. The award is recommended to Marketing Alternatives Incorporated in a total amount not to exceed $300,000. Again, our share would be $150,000 since IDOT reimburses 50%. It should also be noted that the vendor has achieved the 20% BEP goal placed on this procurement, and they also committed to the same for the renewal term.
Any idea how Illinois or the tollway response compares to responses in other jurisdictions?
As far as the time it takes us to respond?
Well, no, I was thinking the number of people who actually contact us. I'm just, which to me suggests whether people know about it or not.
Yeah, there's signs throughout our system in IDOT's road up in our section right. to use this number, STAR 999, to report incidents.
Yeah,
on
and
road.
I'm just wondering if those are conspicuous enough, frequent enough. I just would be curious at some point if we can say what happens in other jurisdictions, how does our number per vehicle that travel our roads compare to...
Sure.
How many calls did we have last year?
We average over 130,000 a year.
John Bindar, our manager, was
over 130,000.
Maybe he's not there, so maybe you can answer.
Yeah, since inception of the program, we've run, in some cases, over 300,000 calls with the service. We seem to be seeing a decline in its usage in recent years, and we're currently discussing with IDOT what the future of the STAR 9 program should be. STAR 9 actually came into existence before 911 systems were created. This program is actually a couple years older than the 911 systems, and that's part of the discussion that we're having. It provides for a non-emergency service, if you will, for people driving throughout the region. In terms of percentage of calls, there's a higher percentage of calls regarding IDOT's roads than there are tollways, but it will vary based on construction and activity. And actually, some of the calls are for county roads and other roads within the region, not tollway or IDOT. But it does fill a void in terms of the non-emergency type calls that relate to transportation in the region.
Well, I'm glad you're reviewing it. Feels as if it would make sense to track it against what happens in other places.
One of the things that Illinois does not have a 511 system. Mm-hmm. Okay, most of the adjacent states, in fact, most of the states across the country have a 511 system, and so people have an alternative to 911. That is a big discussion in the state, because to embark upon a 511 system would be certainly costly, much more costly than the Star 9 program. So since we don't go throughout the state, IDOT really has the say in terms of 511, and we continue to work with them for the area that we have jurisdiction over. So.
And just to be profoundly paid, we're paying half, they're paying half. How many more calls do they get than we get, you know, proportionally? Like,
on a percentage-wise, in a typical year, 28% of the calls relate to IDOT, 18% of the calls relate to the tollway, and the remainder relate to all other highways within the region. So actually, it's a service that's paid for by the tollway and IDOT that provides a benefit to counties and communities and others in the region.
Which undoubtedly nobody notices.
It's pretty transparent to everybody. I mean, we do notice if we hype the Star 9 program on our dynamic message signs, that call volumes will increase for a period of time, and so both us and IDOT will use that as a reminder, particularly during heavy traffic periods and that. But and we still think there's a need for the service, but certainly a much lesser need than what we saw 10 years ago, and that's why we're meeting with IDOT to determine what the future of this program ought to be.
Thank you.
That's all we have.
Okay. Any questions about items 2, 4, and 5? If not, any objection to taking those together? We're under motion to approve under procurement items 2, 4, and 5.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Move to approval consent and board agenda. Thank you, John. Engineering and a presentation on the Balmoral Avenue Bridge.
Repairs.
All right, we're in business. Okay, this morning myself and Greg are going to talk to you about the Balmoral Bridge hit, which I believe everyone is aware of. Is this the right clicker, or did you steal the clicker?
Mike's got the clicker.
I have a comment in this presentation specifically for Mr. Kelsey. Oh, okay. Okay, now if it would just work.
You turned it off.
That is out.
Okay, the Balmoral Bridge, which is on the Tri-State just south of Bilyear Interchange, was struck at 1:20 p.m. on June 9th, on June 3rd. I have my glasses, but not on. What you see there is the fascia beam, which suffered severe damage as a result of the hit. The fascia beam supports the outside sidewalk and parapet of the bridge. That's the truck that hit it. It pretty much got demolished. The truck was carrying asphalt grindings that came from off the system and were being transported to an unknown location. The box on the truck was up in the air. He managed to miss the signs, the overhead signs, in advance of the Balmoral Bridge, but unfortunately his box was sufficiently high enough that he exceeded the clearance on the bridge when he hit it. Maintenance crews immediately responded and began removing debris. What you see there are crews working on the left side of the beam in an attempt to de-debris or take all the loose concrete off with the intent of trying to open lanes as quickly as possible. We were able to restore two lanes of traffic northbound by 2:36 p.m., or a little over an hour after the initial hit. So it was a pretty quick response by maintenance to at least get some traffic moving. Unfortunately, because of the volume of the tri-state in the afternoon, we ultimately had backups all the way down to Cicero or to Cermak Road. So we had significant backups through the effort. What you see crews starting to do on the remainder of the bridge is to protect it and wrap it. So we had several crews working to essentially take chain link fence, attach it to the underside of the bridge with filter fabric on the bottom of it in order to contain the damaged beam and prevent additional concrete from dropping. It's an actual underside view looking up at the beam of what the chain link fence looks like with the filter fabric. That's to keep additional rocks and concrete or other debris from falling on traffic. Greg's going to talk in terms of the next steps.
Okay. This was an emergency, so we did this work as an emergency affidavit. The first thing we need to do is identify a contractor to make the repairs. The choice was Lorig. Lorig built the bridge in the early 90s as part of the tri-state widening contracts. This bridge actually then got hit in the late 90s, same beam, and Lorig did that repair. And then Lorig just finished some work in 2011 for the Balmoral Interchange, where they widened the bridge to the north. After that, we had to develop a plan. We knew we needed to immediately remove that damaged beam as quickly as possible. We're going to have to order a replacement beam. That takes 4 to 6 weeks. And then we're going to need to complete the repair. The goal is to get it done by August 1st. Rosemont does have an event scheduled for August 1st. Timeline, so they requested that we try to meet that date. Had to determine a removal method to take the beam out. There's a lot of different ways you can do it. Last time they actually had some cranes out there. They were trying to put some chains around the beam and lower it. That didn't really work. It worked last time, but not that well. This time we determined that we were just going to drop the beam on the pavement. We put some crane mats out there. Crane mats are nothing more than large timbers that go on top of the pavement to protect the pavement from any damage. We've used that method a lot on the system.
Just for fun, how much would a beam like that weigh?
About 200 tons.
Oh, of course.
The work needed required a full closure of the northbound I-294, so I'll turn it over to John to talk about the detour.
It's the first time in our history that we've deliberately detoured a segment of our system, and so when you take the largest and busiest segment of our system, it required a great deal of effort on the part of several people to make this happen. We enlisted the assistance of CDM Smith, our traffic consultant, to do a quick and formal traffic detour plan because it is an interstate-to-interstate detour, and they reviewed all the numbers. We looked at a couple options. One was 88, taking northbound traffic west on 88 to 355 north, keeping everybody on our system, but we would have inadvertently hooked people for an additional toll at Army Trail Road, and that was not decided to be a good idea. We then talked with IDOT about using 290, which splits off just north of Plaza 35, the 88 interchange, and IDOT was very much in agreement with using that route. So we had excellent cooperation from DOT. Very quickly, a lot of this was done verbally in order to make things happen. Okay. We also contacted the media. Communication did a phenomenal job. This whole effort involved a significant team effort that I'll comment on the last slide. But communication worked part and parcel with us, with our consultants, in putting together a plan and going over the details and what was a very dynamic, changing plan as we reviewed things. This slide is from Mr. Kelch. We were able to, throughout the entire Chicagoland region, the network, us, the Illinois Department of Transportation, the Indiana Department of Transportation, have in place numerous dynamic message signs that we use for communicating to our customers. And we were able to, through the relationships established through the Lake Michigan Interstate Gateway Alliance, LAMIGA, which is a group that we belong to. In fact, the LAMIGA meeting is occurring in about a half an hour downstairs. We were able to cross-border and cross-agency message, both early on alerting our customers that the closure was coming on Saturday night, but then changing messages dynamically throughout the evening in order to communicate good, accurate information. We had a total of 25 or more dynamic message signs between ours, IDOTs, and NDOTs involved in this effort. This graphic is tough to read, but there were actually various zones that were identified that were part of the traffic management plan. And where we didn't have a dynamic message sign, the little green dots show you where we put portable changeable message signs. Again, verbally, we called IDOT. IDOT gave us verbal approval to message and put units on their system very seamlessly. So we had an excellent level of cooperation. And we were able to control these signs and message throughout the evening, actually the days leading up to, and then actually during the closure itself. Okay. The timeline of the beam removal. Am I doing this one? Okay. Greg's going to take you through the timeline of what happened on the night of the event.
Okay, Saturday, June 8th, 7 p.m., they did a two-lane closure northbound on 294. That was to allow the contractor to start setting up his equipment and getting his operations ready. 8 p.m., we did a two-lane closure southbound in order to provide a buffer for that traffic. 9:30 p.m., the eastbound Balmoral Avenue was closed so that the contractor was able to get set up on top in order to do his work. 10 p.m., we put a three-lane closure in northbound. 11:10, the Blackhawks won in overtime. Whenever we do work like this, we do take into account the different events and sporting events that's happening in the area. So we were monitoring this just to see if there would be any impact from the traffic coming from that game onto the operations. There's also the Blackhawks. You know, he had to watch the game.
We anticipated that their game would be over and that pretty much most of the traffic would have flushed past the tri-state, but unfortunately they went into overtime, and so actually they let out after the game right when we were in the midst of choking the tri-state down. The good news is it did not have a significant impact on our effort. So, but we do watch those things. And
okay, 11:30, we did the northbound Cermak Road Toll Plaza ORT closure in order to get everybody through onto the cash lane so we can start funneling traffic for the detour. We also closed the left lane of the two-lane ramp from the I-88 to I-294. 12 o'clock midnight was when we instituted the detour. Going into Sunday at 12 a.m. was when the contractor began his work. So that gives us an idea that it took us about 12 minutes to flush the traffic out after the detour started. At 2:05, the beam came down. At 3:30 a.m., we were able to open up all lanes in the southbound direction on 294. By 5:30 a.m., we opened up two lanes northbound on 294, thus removing the detour. By 7:32 a.m., all cleanup was done, and all the northbound lanes on the tri-state were open to traffic.
In terms of the detour that we were able to effect, we used a maximum number of mobile vehicles. The ORT closure at Plaza 35 was an excellent move because we're used to doing that and doing ORT maintenance, and it gave us an ability to pull all the northbound traffic, control it, drop it down to a couple lanes, and then eventually run it through the detour. Total maintenance personnel involved in the various closures at the various locations. We had 29 equipment operator laborers from several maintenance garages that were pulled together, as well as 8 field staff and 4 or 5 managerial staff in here. This whole effort was coordinated by our incident manager, Steve Musser, who was actually in the traffic center for the entire event, and he had camera access over everything and was able to monitor how well things were going. And the next, we have a video to show you of how this all went down. It's a time-lapse video. The total time to drop the beam was around 2 hours, and there's about 5 hours or 4 or 5 hours of cleanup afterwards, but this is a time lapse. What you see there is a contractor has a crane-mounted hammers that are disconnecting the beam at either end. You'll notice on the bottom on the pavement, that's the cribbing that was installed. It's huge, huge timbers that are tied together. They call them crane mats. They're used to provide a stable surface for a crane to work on. What he's doing now is disconnecting the fascia beam from the remainder of the deck. You recall we said that this beam was replaced once before he was able to follow the joint line. right down the bridge and disconnect it. The flashes you see are guys cutting the reinforcing steel. And again, this effort took about 2 hours. You'll notice in a minute that the center of the bridge will start to sag. And they're breaking it out in the middle right now in an attempt to control drop the bridge in two pieces. You see it buckle down. Now it's bound up in the center, so they're both working on that. In a minute, you'll see a crane entering from down below on the left, or a backhoe with a hammer on it. They're cutting some additional steel. They get out of the way, the bridge starts to go down. And then the side hammer comes in to release the rest of the binding. And through the wonders of modern technology, we were able to slow that down so you could actually see it. And now we speed it up and drop the remaining two portions of the beam. A phenomenal effort on the part of the contractor. He clearly had his A-team at work. We monitored everything that he did out there, and there was absolutely no wasted motion on the part of Lorig and his team. If all goes well, you're going to see a time-lapse video of the cleanup. And again, what they did was they moved all three breakers down, and they had two loaders, multiple dump trucks, and this is the cleanup effort. This runs for a minute or two. This image is actually shot from one of our TIMS cameras located on the Balmoral ramp. And it's a little confusing because we kept zooming in order to see various activities. It was impressive in real-time motion. It is really wild when you put it in time-lapse, but it actually took less time to drop the beam and clean it up than it took maintenance to protect and wrap the beam when the first hit took place. But a phenomenal effort. It's the final stages. We've now opened up two lanes of traffic at 5 in the morning, and then by 7:32 everything was opened. Okay, current conditions, do you want to talk on this or... Okay, right now all lanes are open on the tri-state. The beam has been removed. The one lane on Balmoral remains closed eastbound, but there are two lanes on that bridge, four lanes, so the one lane eastbound is open. The contractor will need that area to work on it, and that's all being protected right now. But traffic northbound on the tri-state is pretty much seamless right now. We expect to have, our goal is to have everything completed by August 1st, and so we'll be back there doing beam erection sometime, hopefully in mid to late July. That erection will not require a detour because they'll position the beam and get it in place and actually lift it with a short-term overnight closure and put the new beam in place and then button everything up. General Consultant ACOM is actually working with the contractor on this. They'll be spearheading the management and coordination. What was really noteworthy was the phenomenal coordination from beginning to end. The responsive maintenance going out there initially on the scene and making emergency repairs, restoring some traffic, and just about every department in the agency has had a hand in working together to make this all come together. Business systems, communications, engineering, obviously, finance and operations, procurement. Illinois State Police District 15, very close coordination with them in terms of our resources and deployment that night of the actual detour. I can't say enough about IDOT and their response and verbally authorizing us to do all kinds of things that typically would require permits. Village of Rosemont, who was Johnny on the spot right after the hit with their engineering firm and provided assistance. So local police from Rosemont, who helped us throughout the entire detour and removal effort overnight. AECOM, who's had a strong presence right after the hit as well as in preparing plans and figuring out the repair. CDM Smith and analyzing the regional traffic and helping us put together the messaging plan with our TIM staff, and HMTB, who's been keeping track of the numbers and providing the estimates for this entire project. So, I mean, it's an unfortunate hit. It's the second time this beam's been replaced. But the good news is we dealt with it pretty effectively. There was some disruption of our customers, but I think because of the combined effort of all the people that were involved, we were able to minimize that and certainly get the word out. It was absolutely amazing that most everybody knew that there was going to be a detour that night, and so we were not inconveniencing too many people in that whole effort. So with that, any questions or...
I've got some questions, but first I want to say, you know, proud to be a board member and have this, all the departments work so well together. It was a Herculean effort to get this repair done. It was amazing to watch that time lapse video. Very impressive, and congratulations, and what a great proud moment for the tollway.
Yeah, thank you.
The other question I have are, what are we doing to work with the trucking industry with alarms in the cabs? It seems to be a growing issue here with these cabs that are, the beds that are going up.
Yeah, we've had some particular problems the last couple of years, more so than what we normally would have in a 10-year period. We have changed our specifications and are requiring that all trucks that are hauling for our contracts on the tollway to be equipped with a warning device that warns the driver, either audibly or with a flashing light, that his box is in the air. Unfortunately, that scenario would not have impacted this. This is a private concern who was hauling from asphalt from another job off our system, and we're simply the means of transportation. So I don't know, short of a state law that might require that, yeah, that's indeed a possibility.
Is that something we would work with the industry to maybe get some?
We have had meetings already with the Illinois Truckers and the Midwest Truckers Associations and talked to them. We've actually used their communication means to their drivers to warn them and to talk to them. And that initial conversation wasn't about bridge hits, but was about crashes and just, you know, some of the difficulties we've had on I-90 in that construction zone. They've been very receptive, very cooperative. It is an issue across the industry, and we're not unique. We're not the only agency in the country that has had a series of these things occurring lately.
And we're lucky it wasn't a serious, more serious injuries with the bed hitting down.
The driver wasn't injured at all, and there were no other. There were several vehicles that caught concrete debris that have claims against the company, but unfortunately.
The other issue to maybe for Mike is the business loss, and I guess the loss of the tollway when something like this happens, and then when we do the repair again on August 1st, or before August 1st, what that anticipated loss is to the tollway.
Yeah, it's what we call loss revenue potential. And actually, the Traffic Operations Safety Committee, which is a monthly committee of all departments that meets, started addressing this issue almost a year ago and has now made a recommendation that consideration be given to putting it into our contract specifications with regard to potential loss revenue and damages, and actually assigning a value per segment of the road as a penalty, if you will, a loss revenue number for any and all crashes. So whether it be a crash caused by our contractor or damage caused by our contractor or even a private, you know, crash that occurs that has an impact on revenue, we've identified what that number is for each segment of the road. And at this point, it's a question as to whether we need to bring that to the board and adopt that as a policy agency-wide. We've done lost revenue assessments in the past, but not widespread, and that's what's currently under discussion. But, yeah, there is potentially a financial impact. Even if traffic comes to a complete stop on the system, obviously we're not collecting revenue, and some of that traffic is going to divert. Sometimes it's tough to get a handle on what that number is, but we have put together a recommendation and maybe actually be bringing that back to the board for a policy decision at some point soon.
But John, even without that policy, we'll still have claims against...
Well, we still go after them anyhow. That's correct.
And I know Mike's group, through Don Hawk, our insurance manager, is coordinating that claim and with our own insurance company as well as the truckers insurance company.
So yeah. Is it a claim for the cost of the rebuild and construction as well as a claim for the lost revenue?
Yeah, both of those, right?
Everything you saw in the video... plus everything in preparation for the detour and that which you didn't see, plus the repair of the bridge will all be assessed against the offending vehicle. And that's done by statute. So if the lost revenue is a component of that. In some cases, we've been fortunate where we've actually been able to divert traffic on our system and we haven't had a huge loss of revenue in some crashes, but other crashes, it's a severe hit. So.
I mean, our operations, you know, in response to this demonstrate that, you know, we are customer focused. We do realize, you know, closing down the road is a big deal. So I really appreciated how engineering and Greg's staff and John's staff responded initially and getting the lanes open as soon as possible, and then even how they proceeded with the, you know, dropping the beam down at the best time so that we would inconvenience the least amount of people. And the contractor, I mean, they also understood, and it was obvious in how they were working and how they were addressing this operation that they were very cognizant of, you know, how important it was to do the work quickly and efficiently. So initially I wasn't too excited about showing something actually